We are very honored to have with us today the pioneering urban economist Edward Glaser. Edward Glaser is the Fred and Eleanor Glimp Professor of Economics at Harvard University, where he directs the Taubman Center for State and Local Government and the Rappaport Institute for Greater Boston. Professor Glaser received his BA degree from Princeton University and his PhD degree from the University of Chicago. He is noted for his studies of the economics of cities, housing, crime, and innovation, and writes about many of these issues as a columnist for the Bloomberg View. Ed Glaser is also the author of the best-selling book, Triumph of the City, How Our Greatest Invention Makes Us Richer, Smarter, Greener, Healthier, and Happier. So with no further ado, we give you Ed Glaser.
I'm really very honored and delighted to be here. My father was a curator at the Museum of Modern Art, and my mother was in the JDR Third Fund funding Asian artists. So I grew up around the arts, although I have absolutely no artistic sensibility whatsoever, as you will shortly find out. Because I want to start with something that I call a portrait of America, and I call it, of course, a portrait to make it clear my complete lack of any aesthetic sense whatsoever. But what we've done, what I've done, is I've taken the 3,000-odd counties in the United States, and I've ranked them on the basis of density, people per square mile, because at their hearts, cities are the absence of physical space between people and firms. They are density, proximity, closeness. And each dot represents 300-odd counties. And what the bottom line shows is the relationship between per capita incomes and density. The densest tenth of America's counties have incomes that are on average 50% higher than the least dense half of America's counties on a per capita basis. The three largest metropolitan areas in this country produce 18% of America's GDP, while including only 13% of our population. This is a well-known fact, and it reminds us of the enduring economic might of our metropolitan areas that are anchored in dense cities. The top fact is perhaps a little bit more surprising, for it shows the relationship between population growth between 2000 and 2010 and population density as of the year 2000. So whereas at the start of the 19th century, we left our dense enclaves on the Atlantic seaboard of the United States to populate the interior of this great continent, at the start of the 21st century, we're increasingly moving towards being around each other. We're moving to places that are already dense. Now, that, in a sense, is a paradox, right? It's a paradox that cities remain as vibrant and as powerful as they are in America today, and even more so in the outside world, right? We've just reached past that remarkable halfway point where now more than half of humanity lives in cities. And it's hard not to think that on net that's a relatively good thing, because if you compare those countries that are more than 50% urbanized to those countries that are less than 50% urbanized, the more urbanized countries have, on average, incomes that are five times higher and infant mortality levels that are less than a third. The reason this is a paradox, of course, is that we live in an age in which it is effortless to telecommute across the globe, where we could all occupy whatever sylvan spot appeals to our biophilia and just dial it in. And yet, in so many ways, in so many cases, we don't. We choose the inconveniences of city life. We choose the petty disturbances, the petty embarrassments of living in crowded areas. Why is it that we didn't just move to electronic cottages? Why didn't we give up on all this proximity? Now, the strength of cities today, it feels very different than the New York of my youth, right? And these are two iconic images. I was born in 1967 in Manhattan, and these are two iconic images of New York from the 1970s. Gerald Ford did not actually tell New York City to drop dead, but I think most people think he actually meant it. And certainly during those years, it looked like not just Ford, but history itself was telling not just New York, but all of America's older, colder cities, that they were headed for the trash heap of the history, that they were going to go back to some vision as sketched in Planet of the Apes, where the Statue of Liberty would be covered by sand, or, you know, this image of Jimmy Carter wandering through the South Bronx, that the buildings would just gradually disappear and grasslands would sprout up again, covering these once great metropolitan areas. Indeed, the decline of cities seemed so natural because, in some sense, they appear to have lost their basic function. All of America's older, colder cities were part of a great transportation network that we built in the 19th century to make the wealth of the American hinterland accessible. Every one of the 20 largest cities in the U.S. in 1900 was on a major waterway, from the oldest, like New York and Boston, typically where the river meets the sea, to the newest, Minneapolis, on the northernmost navigable point on the Mississippi River. This transportation network was so important because in 1816, it cost more to ship goods 30 miles over land in this country than it did to ship them across the Atlantic Ocean. So we built this amazing network of canals and railroads, and cities grew up on pinch points along that network, like Buffalo on the western terminus of the Erie Canal, or Chicago, the linchpin of a great watery arc that went all the way from New York to New Orleans. And, of course, industries like Chicago stockyards grew up around those transportation networks. And indeed, the stockyards were part of this perennial problem of how is it that you get corn, which is so easy to grow in the American hinterland, even without Department of Agriculture subsidies. That was an unnecessary aside. To markets of the East, and of course, it could be transformed into whiskey, which was the earliest way of doing it, and then into salted beef. And then once Armour figures out refrigerated rail cars, you can slaughter the beef in Chicago and move it east. Now, as transportation costs plummet, and this is the decline of moving a ton of mile by rail over the 20th century in real dollars, the value of these one-time transportation hubs disappeared. And almost all of them declined. They were hit by the move to sun and the move to sprawl. Both of these can be seen as being effects of this transportation revolution. Sprawl, in essence, is rebuilding our urban spaces around the car, just as we in earlier eras rebuilt our urban spaces around streetcars or around elevated rail lines. And the move to sun reflects the fact that as transportation costs plummeted, people were able to move away from areas where firms had a productive advantage because of access to coal mines or access to the Great Lakes, to places that people wanted to live. And apparently the thing that Americans really wanted was warm Januaries, because there's no variable that better predicts metropolitan area growth during the 20th century than January temperature. Now, hit with this move to sun and sprawl over the 20th century, all of America's older, colder cities experienced significant troubles. These were the 10 largest American cities as of 1950. Eight of these 10 lost 20% or more of their population over the next 50 years. Three out of these 10 lost 48% or more of their population over this half century. And indeed, Detroit lost another 25% of its population over the last decade alone. Now, the federal government followed a policy during these years that can in some sense be called the epitome of old growth theory, that really thought that the way to solve declining cities' problems was with structures and infrastructure. Okay, was to work on that physical capital that is so, you know, obvious and therefore attractive to politicians, but so utterly unnecessary in cities that were built for much larger populations than they occupy today. The hallmark of declining cities is that they have an abundance of structures and infrastructure relative to the level of demand, relative to the level of people. More than 90% of the homes in Central City Detroit are valued at significantly below construction costs. If they fell down, no one in their right mind would actually pay to put them up again. And yet, in the 50s and 60s, the federal government stood there with urban renewal dollars, paying to put new structures in declining places. And after the Federal Highway Aid Act of 1973, the feds were there to support transit systems. Now, it's easy to get around downtown Detroit. There aren't a lot of people there anymore, right? And look at these streets. They don't need a monorail to glide over essentially empty streets. It made no sense whatsoever from a transportation planning perspective. But like an old Simpsons episode, the thing is sold to the public as being some transformative investment that's going to bring Detroit back. And, of course, it didn't, right? Now, luckily, not every city experienced the Detroit phenomenon. It's easy to forget today that in 1971, two real estate jokers put up a sign on the highway outside of Seattle asking the last person to leave the town to please turn out the lights, because Seattle's future seemed so grim in the wake of Boeing cutting back on its jobs. Just like when Ford or General Motors cut back on their jobs in Detroit, that city's future seemed uncertain. So did Seattle's in 1971. This is before Starbucks, before Amazon, before Costco, before Microsoft, right? All of these entrepreneurs came in and rechanged the city. But they rechanged it not because of a monorail or because of urban renewal dollars. They changed it because of human capital, because of ideas, because of innovation, because of creativity. Now, it turns out that it's actually fairly easy to explain which cities managed to turn themselves around. And the variable above all that predicts urban success, particularly in the older, colder regions, is human capital, the share of adults with a college degree, as of 1970 or 1960 or 1940, if you prefer. This is the relationship between population growth between 1970 and 2000, and share of the population with a college degree as of the year 1970. It's a nice positive relationship. I've sorted them again into fifths across all metropolitan areas. But this is the relationship in the Northeast and the Midwest. In the older, colder cities, the most skilled fifth of these metropolitan areas achieved growth that was completely different than the bottom fifth. If you want to understand why Seattle looks so different than Detroit, you need look no further than the fact that 12% of Detroit's adults have college degrees and over 50% of Seattle's do. Right, that skills really are destiny. This is the relationship between population growth across all of America's counties between 2000 and 2010 and human capital as of the year 2000. Right? Again, an enormously strong positive relationship. Now, this is where the new growth theory comes in. So, in fact, my own academic interest in cities was very much a product of the University of Chicago in the 1980s when new growth theory was being developed. It really starts with Paul Romer, who solves a mathematical problem of making compatible increasing returns production functions that don't hit a natural barrier with competitive markets. For increasing returns aren't compatible with competitive markets unless the increasing returns are external to the firm, meaning that your activity generates benefits for people outside you. Right? And that was what Paul did. And he called this external benefit knowledge. And it was basically solving a mathematical problem, but it started off an avalanche of new thinking. There was a debate in the 1980s between Paul Romer and his thesis advisor, Bob Lucas, who took the case that knowledge, he was right to emphasize increasing returns, but that those increasing returns were embodied in people, that they reflected human capital externalities. Having skilled neighbors makes us smart, right? This is the basic idea. And some of us, who are not highfalutin theorists, but rather humbler toilers in the gardens of data work, started to look at subnational data as means of testing these ideas. And this is where, in fact, all of my work on cities ultimately came from, was thinking about this. The relationship between human capital and area growth was seen as being a test of Bob Lucas's phenomenon, both in terms of the relationship between skills and subsequent population growth, and also the relationship between skills and productivity. This is the relationship between the share of the population with a BA as of the year 2000 and per capita GDP, and this is what's called the measured human capital externality. So what this does is it takes your wages holding your years of schooling constant, and then it relates that to the share of the population in your area with a college degree. This work was pioneered by Jim Rausch in 1993, explicitly working off Lucas's work on this, and more recently Enrico Moretti has taken up the ball. What this shows is that as the share of the population with a college degree in your metropolitan area goes up by 10%, your wages go up on average by 8%, holding your own years of schooling constant. And there is a lengthy economics literature that attempts to tease out the causality issues, and it's using things like having a land-grant college in your metropolitan area prior to 1940 to get something that feels a little bit like more exogenous on this. Education, of course, also predicts unemployment, and it overpredicts it relative to the general relationship at the individual level between education and employment. So there appears to be positive externalities there as well. Now, the role of human capital in making us more productive, people who are skilled around us and making us more productive, which points to at least part of the Lucas view of new growth, also helps explain why cities came back. What globalization and new technologies have done is that they've increased the returns to skill, and we have literally hundreds of papers documenting that fact. They've increased the returns to innovation, and they've increased the complexity of the world, because you can sell it on the other side of the planet, because you can source it on the other side of the planet. And we are a social species that gets smart by being around other smart people. By increasing the returns to skill, you've increased the returns to cities, to proximity, because you've made the world more complicated, and it's so easy for ideas to get lost in translation. Anyone who's ever taught knows the hard part of teaching is not knowing your script. It's knowing whether or not anything you're saying is getting through, right? When you're not in the same room, when you're not connecting with each other, right, you lose all those wonderful cues for communicating comprehension or confusion that we have developed over millions of years, right? And you also lose when you're not in the midst of a creative cluster, those unplanned episodes where we pick up things that we couldn't possibly have known, right? No one graduates from an Ivy League college, you know, and learns to be a software entrepreneur by looking it up in Wikipedia, right? They have to go there and be in the heart of Silicon Valley to actually learn it. And indeed, it's a striking piece of evidence supporting the notion that new technology and face-to-face contact are more complements than substitutes, that Google, which of all the companies in the world should be able to do long-distance production, builds the Googleplex. So its workers are right on top of each other. This is the relationship between skills in 1940 and subsequent growth in the population with BAs. Initial skills were associated with far faster growth. But the most important things that are learned at the metropolitan area level surely have nothing to do with what we teach in school. Indeed, I'm often puzzled whether or not anything I teach in school has any economic value whatsoever outside the classroom. And certainly it's hard to think about anything that's more valuable than the skills and inclination to be an entrepreneur. This is where I actually got involved in the New Growth Theory. I did also some of the early work on skills and urban growth, but specifically looking at firm size, and there was a debate between this literature as to whether or not you wanted lots of small, nimble firms or versus large firms that would internalize all these externalities. What we found at the metropolitan area level was there was an incredibly strong advantage of having lots of little firms. And the interpretation that I now prefer of this is that these areas, right, with lots of little firms are places that have entrepreneurial human capital, have the skills and inclinations to start your own enterprises. This was an idea that was first floated by Ben Chinnitz 50 years ago when he compared New York and Pittsburgh and noticed that New York was more entrepreneurial than Pittsburgh even then. Sorry, was more resilient than Pittsburgh even then. And he credited New York's industrial history, the garment district, which was a mother of entrepreneurship because basically anyone with an idea and a couple of sewing machines could get started. Whereas U.S. Steel produced company men, right? And when the steel industry went down, they didn't know what else to do. But the New York's garment guys, I mean, the garment industry in New York was the largest industrial cluster in the United States in the 1950s, bigger than automobile production in Detroit. And it was hammered by globalization during the 1960s, losing 500,000 people over a very short time period. And yet those people were able to come back. They were able to do something else. Right? Sanford Weill, I believe, Citigroup, his father was a garment entrepreneur. A.E. Lefcourt, who built more skyscrapers than any other New Yorker in the 1920s. He started as a garment entrepreneur. The other fact that we found when testing for this was the advantage of industrial diversity. That effect is less strong than the employment, than the firm size effect. But what this shows is we're looking at industrial concentration and employment growth, 1977 to 2000. It's actually the highest in the second quintile here, but there is on net a statistically significant positive effect between having a more diverse urban area industrially and subsequent growth. Now, along with the economic resurgence of our particularly skilled metropolitan areas, and I will get to the art shortly, is the rise of the consumer city, is the fact that our cities in an increasingly wealthy, increasingly educated world where problems of crime have gotten under control have become places of remarkable pleasure as well as productivity, because the same urban edge and innovation that makes cities productive also makes them fun, also makes for good restaurants, and the same large scales that can make for factories or other productive units also makes museums possible. Measures of amenities are very strongly correlated with subsequent growth in the United States. This is one measure of it. And you've seen this remarkable transformation where you used to have to pay people a wage premium to locate in cities, and now you no longer need to do that. Now, I've spent a lot of time thinking about cities and the arts in my life, and I think my favorite reason for bringing the arts is because they are the best illustration of the urban ability to spread ideas, right? The best way we see breakthroughs move from person to person is actually in the arts. And sometimes we see them depicted visually, like Raphael's School of Athens, but we also see them in the Italian Renaissance, right? Which you can think about as starting with Brunelleschi's ability, at least in terms of the pictorial element of it, Brunelleschi's ability to figure out how linear perspective works, to enable the production of three-dimensional spaces, which then gets passed to his friend Donatello. This is the low-relief sculpture below the statue of St. George in Orson Michele, right? And you can see the perspective in action, which gets passed, of course, to Masaccio in the Brancacci Chapel. You can again see the three-dimensionality of the space, who then gets passed to that less-than-saintly monk Fra Filippo Lippi and so forth. A chain of genius, each person building on each other's idea, which is, we can tell a similar story about Shakespeare in 16th-century London. We can tell a similar story about architecture in 19th-century Chicago, where the skyscraper is created not by a lone genius, but by a cluster, many of whom get started in the offices of William LeBaron Jenney, like Burnham and Sullivan. But no one of them can properly be called the father of the skyscraper. The home insurance building, Jenney's masterpiece, only has a load-bearing steel skeleton in the front walls. The back walls are traditional masonry walls. And indeed, Sullivan, Burnham, Adler, Root, all of them are part of this remarkable chain of invention where you see the city at its best, its ability to both transform itself and create visionary ideas that enable all of humanity to live better. Now, when we think about the implication of these sort of clusters of genius, these chains of collaborative creativity for arts policy, it's quite easy to note that artistic clusters have long existed and have often created great results. But it's hard to know necessarily if that means that arts support should be targeted into clusters or not. We heard a nice paper earlier talking about how these cultural districts do appear to be related to patenting activity. But it is very, very hard for the state to manage creativity, right? It's very, very hard for the government to figure out how these clusters work. And in general, trying to move people into clusters inevitably means you're taking away from one area and bringing them into another, which means one area's loss is another place's gain. And it's hard to balance those things off. Even if we are utterly confident that the arts creates enormous externalities for the world, we can't be confident that we know how to actually manage the connections between individual values of individual clusters of artists. Now, when we think about the reasons for having an arts policy, the reasons for subsidizing the arts, I think the best reason for this is not local economic development policy at all. Right? And I think it is actually a mistake for the arts to try and sell itself too much as an economic development policy. Because the real reason to subsidize art is because art makes life worthwhile. Right? Because art has enormous intrinsic value that is not to do with whether or not we actually, see local GDP work or not. Now, there's nice economics work, and I have Doug's work, which I didn't even know was on the program when I put this up. I want this noted. Looking at the impact of better architectural buildings on selling prices. Vandel and Lane find a 22% gap in price between top and bottom architectural quality in Chicago. Some of this work tends to find that older buildings have less of a premium to architectural quality than newer buildings. But the big issue is, of course, the external benefit of art, is the value that you get by walking past a thing of beauty every day and seeing the benefit from that. And that's actually a far harder thing. There is, of course, an extensive economic literature, but I think it's very far from settled in terms of this. Now, what we heard this morning, and it's certainly how I think about it, is I see there as being a strong link between arts-based policies and human capital. I often say the best local economic development strategy is to attract and train smart people and then get out of their way. Right? And that's not a recipe for laissez-faire. That's a recipe for actually creating a city that is attractive for highly skilled people. It is hard not to think that the arts are part of this, right? So this is the relationship between, let's say, the first one just shows visiting an art gallery or museum and college graduates. So there's a 36% difference between college graduates and high school and people without college degrees in how often they visit an art gallery, right? Skills and art tend to be complements. You're taught to appreciate this stuff in colleges, or you just have natural inclinations which make you like both forms of creativity. This seems to suggest that there's some role for arts to be part of a human capital attraction policy. Now, there is also a tendency, this is the relationship between per capita museums, this is a Z-score, meaning it's mean zero, one standard deviation of one, and the share of adults with a college degree as of 1990. That's also positive. But there is something, if you're inclined to look at it, if you're inclined to sort of look at it hopefully, that does suggest that having museums initially is associated with upgrading of human capital over time. So a one standard deviation increase in the number of museums per capita increases growth in the share with college degrees from 1990 to 2000 by about 0.2%, right? So it's a positive correlation. This is controlling for a number of other things. It's not huge. There's no visible correlation between museums per capita on income or population growth. House price growth does go up. In these areas. So that's an interesting fact. So I think that this is very non-conclusive, and I think most of the work, quite honestly, on arts and economic outcomes are very non-conclusive. But these are reasons for doing more, and it's particularly why I think we should really be grateful that the NEA is taking seriously its research responsibilities, especially the more that can be done with randomized treatment and control type interventions, the better off we are, because we are at our infancy in understanding this stuff, and we do nobody a service by claiming we know all the answers. But we do everyone a service if we argue for proper scientific evaluation, because I think all of us should be confident enough in the value of the arts to be confident that those studies will actually show in a convincing manner the impact that the arts can have on our lives. I want to end with a final speculation, which is I think it's very hard to know. It's very hard to know the sort of random thoughts that come off from an artistic legacy. This is, of course, Filippo Negroli's shield, right? The great armorer of Milan. And it's hard not to think that this type of imagery played a role in this. This is, of course, Gianni Versace's doorpost, which both has the Medusa shield, which at least to me resonates so much with the great Negroli workshop in Milan. It's also, of course, got the acorns of the Della Rovere popes on top as well. Which I'm not sure has that link either, but it's the unplanned nature of this form of learning and ideas hopping to each other is what we're all hoping for. And in some sense, that creates an enormous challenge for arts funding, because it means that it's so hard to predict, where the economic outcomes will come from and what will actually have an impact. And I think this very much, to me, suggests for investing in basic human infrastructure rather than trying to micromanage everything, to sort of fund in competitive ways artists, particularly early on and starting out, as being the right way to push stuff forward, rather than to think that we actually know how to manage the larger ecosystem. But again, the right way to know if that's right or not is randomized treatment and controls, and that's how we'll learn forward on it. But I remain completely confident that art and the cities that create art are headed for a bright future. And I believe very strongly that we have shown a remarkable ability as a species to work miracles over the last 3,000 years in the arts above all, and I have every confidence that will continue in the years ahead. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That was brilliant. It was very, very interesting. I'm going to start us off with just one question, and then we'll open it up to the audience with the time remaining. This morning, we heard a number of presentations about the relationship between the local economy and local arts activities. There are a number of people here from Arts Place, and the endowment's chiefly interested in this topic. If local arts should be supported, how should this be done? And particularly the distinction between supporting buildings like theaters and new art centers versus supporting the arts consumer or local artists.
You know, let's at least somewhat reason by analogy with what we know in terms of the broader economic development strategies, right? The history of America's economic development strategies, both in the U.S. and the outside world, is littered with structure and infrastructure failures. Right, littered with attempts to lay down large physical footprints that, you know, were claimed to work magic, and they sure do look impressive when they get opened. Right, and yet the payoff on this is, you know, is often absolutely awful. Right? On the other hand, investments in charter schools, right? Investments in Head Start, investments in programs that directly target aid, particularly to disadvantaged populations, have enormous impacts. We can only know if the same thing is true in the arts world through the types of randomized controls that we've had for Head Start or other things. But certainly, that type of evidence would make me lean towards a view that emphasized investing in people rather than investing in structures. Right? One of the amazing things about art is that it is, you know, often when it is shown in the most creative and surprising places that can often be most magical, which to me at least suggests against the need for creating very large, very expensive forms of museum infrastructure relative to encouraging people from the ground up to just create more space. And I think another reason why art can be such a valuable thing in terms of creating urban amenities is that you can often see just wonderful things that can make a local space more attractive far more cheaply than a vast form of local infrastructure investment, because you've unleashed the artists, because you've given them some freedom to do something with their own resources and to make the space more attractive. And I think that's something that is, you know, at least to me, it leans me towards people rather than structure.
Okay, we'll take one or two questions.
So I appreciated your point that the reason for supporting the arts is because art is intrinsically valuable and not because of its growth impacts. And you talked about the kind of externality of walking past a beautiful work of art or something, which makes me think that a lot of that externality is really a local externality. And if that's the case, then wouldn't the value of those local externalities kind of be reflected in property values? And if that's the case, to the extent that that's the case, does that mean that support through property taxes is an appropriate way of supporting local arts?
Well, you know, there are two questions that are involved here, one of which is the research angle of how do we actually measure this, and the other of which is the public policy impact. So certainly there's some impact, some, you know, degree of literature of looking at things like historic preservation districts and so forth, though there, the actual district itself captures the impact of a supply restriction. Of having a district as well. So it's not just about the beauty of the buildings, it's about the supply restriction. Both things are going on. The property values will only capture one modest piece of it, right, because it only captures the value to the person of living close to it relative to walking by it or experiencing it on a daily basis. So I think it is actually relatively muted, our ability to actually measure this straight away with property values. In the case of what you think the local government should spend on, I personally have always been in favor of particularly low-cost artistic innovations that make an area more attractive. When it gets to higher-cost interventions, you're up against, you know, school kids. You're up against other things that the local government can do, and you need to sort of take seriously the fact that you have limited constraints on this. And the arts deserves a place at the table, but it doesn't automatically follow that we should, you know, cut back spending on four-year-old Head Start programs for disadvantaged four-year-olds to fund anything else. So,
I think we may have time for one or two more.
Hi, David Cohen, Department for Professional Employees, AFL-CIO. On your line of investing in people rather than structures, does the investment in education include arts education?
I can only speak as a parent, right? I mean, I don't think there's anything more important that I do with my kids than, you know, subject them to far too much art. As a consumer, I was unfortunately not blessed with any particular talents, which may be why it's not likely I'm going to win a Nobel Prize anytime soon. Sure. I mean, we just need to be smart about these things. And there also are, you know, engaging ways in which we can sort of combine arts and technology in terms of teaching that's worthwhile. But again, we need to fundamentally be focused on any educational intervention. We need to, you know, ask about what the impact is. We need to randomize. We need to look at outcomes. And we need to have a non-ideological approach to this, but one that actually asks, what is it that we want to achieve in our children? And we need to actually try and measure that. I certainly think that teaching the arts is an enormously valuable thing.
Yeah. Alan Marco, the Patent and Trademark Office. I had a question. I was intrigued by your point about sort of are we really generating growth in certain areas versus just diverting sort of resources, in a sense. You know, we may see more artists, we may see more employment in one area, but maybe we're just taking it from another area. So from a policy standpoint, I mean, really, it gets to a measurement issue that's a problem, but also one at sort of what level of funding do we do this? You know, what are we doing this at the local, state, federal level? And, you know, what kind of policy recommendations do you have for that?
So it's a great question. I mean, in most areas, I tend to be a localist. Right, so I actually think that the move to federal transportation spending has created a whole lot of mischief relative to actually having transportation spending done more locally. When it comes to redistribution, meaning something that takes care of the bottom fifth, the bottom tenth of America, clearly that has to be done at a national level. If you try to run local welfare states, the wealthy just leave, the wealthy and firms just leave, and you end up with a deprived tenth. Education occupies a middle ground. Right, and actually, I actually welcome the move, as opposed to transportation infrastructure, where I stand against it because of things like that monorail. In the case of education, I actually welcome federal interventions because many of the externalities that are created by education are not just reaped at the local level. They happen by kids who move somewhere else. They happen by people who have ideas that are then benefiting from people around them. Now, here's how I would think about the arts in this. In the part of the arts that's about building human capital, funding young artists, supporting artistic education, whatever, I think of that as being something where the feds have a very strong local role to role to play. When it comes to art that is primarily justified as beautifying a particular piazza, right? That's fundamentally more about the city government rather than about the federal government. So we should be focused on what we think a national policy is to create, and I think that should basically be about the human infrastructure, the human capital related to the arts, which does have sort of nationwide effects, rather than the stuff which is saying, look, we're specifically going to invest in something that's going to create a beautiful thing in this place, which is fundamentally a job for the local government, I think. Time for one.
Joe Courtwright with Impresa and Art Place. Ed, you showed the really strong relationship between density at a metropolitan level and for counties and income growth, and talked about density and human interaction as being key.
That was income levels and population growth. So just right. To be clear, that's income level. More population moving to places that are dense and higher incomes in those areas.
So, and that spoke to levels of density at the aggregate in metropolitan areas. Does that have an implication for how we build our cities? Isn't it the density of particular neighborhoods and the function of the urban core, which is the densest part of the metropolitan area, that is really what we need to be paying attention to?
You know, there's certainly a fair amount of sub-city work showing relationships between productivity and density at the neighborhood level. I'm an economist, right? So I tend not to think that I know how people should live or how developers should build, right? I mean, these are an issue of local circumstances, and, you know, I believe very strongly in people having freedom. I'm in this crazy situation of being someone who loves cities who lives in a suburb, right? So I certainly understand the many forces that people actually have facing them. But in terms of density, I think the right public policy question is not how people should build, but how we should regulate density. And I think the problem that we've so too often seen is that there has been an enormous maze of regulation that has kept density levels down, right, including, of course, right here in Washington, D.C., particularly famously, but also in areas like all of our older cities, perhaps with the exception of Chicago, where starting with the 1916 New York City Zoning Ordinance, we've been very, very heavy-handed in our regulations of local building. I think we've gone too far in this. I think we've made it too difficult to provide new space in urban areas. And in some sense, I think one of the reasons for that is it is so easy to see the costs of building up, the lost light, the added crowding perhaps on the street, the fact that an older building might have to be torn down to create this, and yet the benefits are less obvious. But the benefits can be enormous. Right? They can be the economic vitalization of an area. They can be the fact that by providing new space, you're providing an ability of ordinary people, right, to come and live in an area, to avoid the transformation of an old middle-class city into a boutique town. And yet that's happened too often in our successful older cities. As they've gotten their economic mojo back, as they've seen themselves rise as places of pleasure as well as productivity, those places that have made it excessively difficult to build, and particularly build up, have seen skyrocketing prices, an increasing tendency of the cities to just become, you know, places for the wealthy. You know, this is, I think, there's so much that we have to learn from Jane Jacobs, the very wise observer of cities, but she got this one wrong, right? She looked at old buildings and new buildings, noticed that old buildings were cheap and new buildings were expensive, and this led her to the policy conclusion that we should make sure that we have lots of old buildings instead of allowing people to build new buildings on top of them. Well, that's not how supply and demand works, for goodness sakes, right? I mean, if you try and stop anyone from providing new space on top of old space, you're cutting off supply. You're making it impossible to actually bring new units to market, bring new space to market. And you've seen in district after district, this historic district after historic district, the rising prices and increasing switch from areas that once had African Americans living them and now are overwhelmingly white, once had middle-income people and now are overwhelmingly rich. And you need look no further than her own home district of Greenwich Village. Right, which was a place in which a middle-income family like her and her husband could live in the 1940s and 1950s, and now those kind of townhouses start at $5 million, and hedge fund managers only need apply. Right? And in some sense, there's a lesson there, which is we have to think about the systemic implications of all of our policies, even if they're justified by, you know, local something that looks like sort of the local charm of an area. By overdoing this, we can create enormous systemic consequences that make it difficult for ordinary people to enjoy the benefits of urban living.
Do you want to take another one, or are you...
Sure, one last one for Sudhil, sure.
Great answer.
Yeah.
Thank you, Ed. Sunil Iyengar, Director of Research at the NEA. I just wanted to add, one of the comments you made about, you know, we were differentiating between federal and local intervention, and you said something like, you know, beautifying a piazza, for example, and you see that much more as a local concern and funding and so forth. Can you speak a little bit about your belief in terms of the amounts expended on that? In other words, are you suggesting that, I assume we're talking here about investments in an order of magnitude, say, by federal government and something like that. But in terms of investments that are strategic and that leverage other kind of local funders, I know later on we'll be seeing a paper on the effects of crowding in or crowding out other dollars by federal investments, and I just wondered if you had an opinion on that.
Sure. I mean, I try to carve the difference as being about the purpose, right? So an investment in a local sculpture garden or a local piece of art can be about, if the purpose is really just local, then maybe there's some federal role for it, but it seems unlikely. If what the actual justification is, we are allowing some new art form to be developed, we're allowing some new artists to find something, and we're hoping that that's going to create, you know, new innovations that are then going to reproduce themselves throughout the country. That's part of the same sort of nationwide investments that we do think is a federal responsibility. So I don't think, I mean, I didn't mean to separate out between the actual things that the NEA does or the federal arts policy do. I meant to focus on what the purpose of it is. And if the purpose is overwhelmingly local, meaning it's a reproduction of a sculpture we already know and we're going to fund putting it up in this piazza, it's hard to see what the advantage of it is. If you're allowing some experimental new thing to occur, then that's a different role. And I think it's important to remember that the federal-local relationship, as much of a localist as I fundamentally am, it's always an interesting dance, right? And there's always important things for the federal government to do with local areas, to prod them to do things better, to compete with them in terms of coming out with better policies. And I think that's why you'd never want to say that there was a hard, bright-line rule on anything, because I think there's a lot to be gained from, say, federal education policy prodding localities to do a better job in terms of delivering new schools. We have charter schools in Boston now, more than a few desultory, because of Race to the Top. Because of a federal program which got involved in pushing the Patrick administration to change its policy on this. There are lots of things that creative federal arts policy can do that it needs to continue doing in order to fulfill the role that the arts can play in all of American life. So thank you. Thank you. With that, thank you very, very much.